Hello, and welcome to Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Monday, July 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast. Areas of showers and storms are showing up on the radar to our southwest. However, they will likely wind up missing us just to the south. Extreme southeast Iowa will have a risk of a rain shower later today into tonight, but the vast majority of us will miss out entirely. Plan on highs into the upper 70s. Two more fronts are set to move across eastern Iowa in the coming days, neither of which is expected to produce much action. A range of cool, high pressure will build into the area later this week into the weekend, providing a wonderful finish to the month of July. Turning to the front page now, articles include No ATVs on City Roads in Waterloo, Cedar Falls Monument to Recognize Essential Workers, and we begin reading the lead story, Dancers Highlight Latino Community in Cedar Rapids. The story comes from the Gazette, and the journalist is Marissa Payne. And it begins with a photograph of a woman dancing in costume, and the caption says, Dance instructor Nelly Sanchez performs for her students during a folklorical dance rehearsal in Cedar Rapids, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Donning black shirts and flowing cotton skirts with their hair pinned up in bright colored traditional Mexican braids, a mostly female troupe clacked their dance shoes on the wooden floors of the Northwest Recreation Center. Uno, dos, arrimos, cerramos, Nelly Sanchez, 21, instructed them, motioning for the young dance group to open and close their arms on each count. Their parents, mostly the mothers, who'd picked out their clothes and made their braids in hues of pink, blue, green, and orange, gathered near the door to record their children's dance practice. Andrew Briesco, president of the local chapter of the League of United Latin American Citizens, crouched with a laptop in hand, telling a group on a Zoom call that the ballet folklorico troupe was practicing for its first public performance September 18th at Festival Latino in the McGrath Amphitheater. Quote, This is a sneak preview, said Bree Brisco, whose daughter Paloma is part of the youngest dance group. Listos ya? Instructor Cynthia Salgado, 22, asked. With that, the elder dance group performed El Coyote folk dance from the Mexican state of Sinaloa. Then two instructors, Sanchez and her brother, Rodrigo, danced La Bamba of Veracruz, and four little girls performed El Payerato, a simplified folklorico dance. The Cedar Rapids Gazette reports that every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday since June, these dancers have met for 2 hours to practice ballet folklorico, a choreographed traditional Mexican dance that reflects local culture with ballet characteristics such as pointed toes and exaggerated movements. The Furuzas Culturales group is the first ever folklorico group in Cedar Rapids, making a historic moment for the city and local Latino community. It is made up of children with Mexican and Central American roots, who chose the group's name to capture the strength they see in their cultures. Sanchez, a co-college senior who's danced since age 7, said she first started dancing when she lived on the south side of Chicago with a back of the yards neighborhood council's first folklorico group. She met Salgado in Chicago in the summer of 2016 when they danced for an after-school program and later attended CO together, completely by chance. At Sanchez's first LULAC meeting in December, she said the organization's leaders discussed how high school retention rates for Latino youth, as many drop out early and opt to work instead of pursuing a college education. Sanchez said she grew up surrounded by Latino resources in Chicago and was raised with an awareness of her Mexican heritage, and she attended college on a full-ride scholarship because of her experiences there. Seeing little programming for Latinos around Cedar Rapids, she pitched to LULAC the idea for a dance group. Quote, I was like, I want that for these kids too, because I grew up in disparity and I grew up in a lot of violence, Sanchez said. Quote, I saw that as an opportunity for other kids to grow, unquote. Having attended a predominantly white institution after growing up in minority neighborhoods, Salgado from Chicago's La Villita neighborhood said there is a sense that the Latino community feels hidden in Cedar Rapids. Quote, we both have a voice and the power of our voice is so strong that we're not going to let it not be heard or not use it, especially for these kids, Salgado said. Monica Vallejo, vice president of LULAC, has been key to spreading word about the dance group, mostly by word of mouth. It has grown from fewer than a dozen children to 17 in just a couple of months. Vallejo said the group used to practice at Delaney Park and now practices out of a garage 2 days a week and the Northwest Recreation Center once a week. They still are searching for a larger space to host the growing group and accept more participants. She also wants to raise $5,000 to keep the classes open for all youth, regardless of socioeconomic status, and cover the costs of outfits, shoes, and more. Azalea Zapot, whose 10-year-old daughter, Iveth, is part of the group, said she feels she missed out on learning traditional dances when she was growing up. She is proud to see her daughter learn and share in this part of their culture. Quote, I cannot wait for that day, Zapot said, referring to the September 18th performance. Quote, I think they're going to look so beautiful. Someday, Sanchez said she hopes to see the dance group morph into a resource center that provides mental health services, violence prevention and intervention, Medicaid and legal resources to any Latino who comes to Iowa and needs help navigating barriers to critical services. For now, for the first time, these 17 Latino kids have a program tailored to their culture. Pilar Laguenas Perez, 12, and Alicia Burgos Guzman, 11, both said they were proud to be part of the historic troupe. Quote, I like to be different than anybody else, having different things and different traditions, Laguenas Perez said. The dance, quote, represents who we are, Burgos Guzman said. Quote, it's going to be special since we're the first group doing it. Sanchez said she is nervous for the big performance, fearing the kids will be shunned by people who don't look like them. But the children are ready to step into the spotlight and say, quote, we're here, teaching all kids that they have a voice as Latinos in the United States. Quote, it shows that these little kids, that they have a voice and they are strong enough to teach younger generations and to teach the older generation that it's okay to be different, Sanchez said. Quote, it's okay to come from different backgrounds because ultimately we merge together and we're all one, unquote. Now, the next story was filed by Andy Malone. Future Cedar Rapids Rotary Plaza will honor COVID-19 pandemic's essential workers. Dateline Cedar Falls. In celebration of its upcoming 100th birthday, members of the Cedar Falls Rotary Club have committed to constructing something downtown the community can take pride in for years to come. The club is finalizing the design of a new monument planned between the Little Red Schoolhouse and Barron's Wrap Filling Station on West 1st Street to pay tribute to the essential workers who were and are still on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Quote, we want to represent all the different types of people, from nurses and doctors to delivery drivers and farmers, said member Mike Butler. The Rotarians received the backing of the city council last week, meaning city officials will continue working with the club and in August come up with an agreement regarding future construction and maintenance. Members stressed there will be no cost to the city. a fundraising campaign could kick off as soon as the middle of August for some $200,000. Construction could begin in the spring or summer of next year and wrap up by fall. A dedication ceremony would happen shortly after that. The Rotary Plaza will include a 2-inch thick granite circular floor base between 40 and 50 feet in diameter. In the middle will be 3 polished, dark-colored granite walls, each detached, curved inward at the top, and angled toward the center in a way that looks like they're capable of holding up a scaled-down planet Earth. The center point will be a light fixture. While the monument will not hold a signature blue and green globe, it will have twisted stainless steel rods overarching the 3 granite structures to represent the 7 continents. After all, COVID-19 intruded on people's lives all over the world. The walls will be an estimated 8 feet tall, 5 feet wide, and 8 inches thick. When factoring in the stainless steel rods, the entire creation is projected to be some 14 feet tall. Quote, "We'd like it to look a little bit like Washington, D.C. type of memorial," member Gail Bonsall told the council. 10 feet wide concrete bike paths will be on either side of the monument. They'll stretch from the RAP station to the monument and to the schoolhouse and nearby Exchange Club gazebo. Within the steel components and on the edge of the floor base will be a limestone block bench. Additionally, a separate sign would share more about the monument's purpose, a list of supporters of Rotary Club, and the overall project, and the club's history. Quote, "Names like Roger Levitt and Leroy Redfern and Homer Searley and J.H. Pete and a lot of names through our history have been in Rotary," Butler told the council. "Because of the future construction, an AmVets bench will have to be relocated on the property, and 1 to 3 trees will likely be removed. That was a primary concern of several council members who asked that the priority be saving them, and that at least they would be replaced with new trees. The Rotarians also received words of support, trust, and gratitude from the council. Quote, "We want to build this plaza so it stands on its own for the next 100 years, Butler said. Plans are still being finalized. However, Butler doesn't expect any drastic changes to the design. Our next story was submitted by Maria Cooper. No ATVs, ORVs on city roads in Waterloo. Dateline Waterloo. State legislation now allows more freedom on the road for ATVs and ORVs, but Waterloo won't allow the vehicles on its city streets. Under a new Iowa law, the vehicles can be operated on most gravel roads and on most paved, undivided 2-lane county roads for limited purposes. They also can be driven on 2-lane state highways for purposes such as traveling to a county road. The legislation defines an all-terrain vehicle as having handlebars, a straddled seat for the operator, and 3 to 6 tires. An off-road vehicle has a bench-type seat, steering wheel, and 4 to 8 tires. However, the legislation does not necessarily legalize a vehicle's operation on city streets. It leaves that decision up to each city. Waterloo's city code does not allow for ATV operation on city streets. It does allow ORV operation for limited purposes, including snow removal, gardening, transporting equipment for construction, or parades. Violation of these rules carries a penalty of up to $750. Drivers of ATVs and ORVs on roads must be at least 18 years old and have a valid driver's license. Both of these vehicles must be equipped with proper headlights, tail and brake lights, horn, and rear view mirrors. They must follow traffic signals. The vehicles cannot exceed 35 miles per hour. The legislation allows the vehicles on state highways, but they cannot travel on 4-lane or interstate roads. They can be driven on any county unpaved road. It also states if driving on a state 2-lane highway or county highway, it must be the most direct and accessible route to or from an ATV park, the nearest county road, or the driver's home. Riders may cross a four-lane highway at an intersection from an authorized road as long as it is not an interstate highway. As for other unconventional vehicles, the past ordinances still stand. Mopeds are allowed on all city streets. Motorized or e-bikes are not allowed on sidewalks. The city asked people to call the Waterloo Police Department at area code 319-291-4340 for more information. Now turning the page, the story at the top is titled Clinic Braces for Tide of Out-of-Staters, and the story is written by the Associated Press. Dateline, Duluth, Minnesota. On the top floor of a modest two-story brick building near the shore of Lake Superior, the executive director of Northern Minnesota's only abortion clinic flits from room to room, checking in patients, fielding phone calls from people seeking appointments, and handling billing questions from those struggling to pay. In the waiting room at We Health Clinic in Duluth, patients from Wisconsin and Texas sit among Minnesotans. The leading edge of an expected uptick in out-of-state patients following the Supreme Court's removal of the federal right to abortion. Quote, "It's just been really busy," Lori Casey, the executive director, said. Quote, "We're trying to be as flexible as we can, especially with people coming out of state. A lot of our patients, even if they're from Minnesota, travel 1 to 3 hours each way to get here. So we try to be as accommodating as we can," unquote. Even before Roe v. Wade was reversed, We Health Clinic was the nearest abortion provider for some people in northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Today, the clinic's employees are acutely aware of their state's status as an island for legal abortion in the Upper Midwest. Abortion is now illegal or treated as such in Wisconsin and South Dakota. North Dakota is expected to follow suit in late July, and Iowa's Republican governor asked the state courts to severely limit the procedure. The clinic raised its cap on patients from 16 to 20 on the one day a week when abortions are typically performed. Its staff try to schedule abortions on other days when necessary and may set aside an additional half or full day each week for abortion services. Quote, "We haven't overcome our capacity to serve patients yet, and we are working on efficiencies so that we're ready if we do end up with a flood of patients," said Dr. Judith Johnson, one of three doctors providing abortions at the clinic. Johnson said the increased pressure began months before the Supreme Court decision, with inquiries from people in Texas and Oklahoma as those states introduced highly restrictive abortion bans. The extra patient load at We Health Clinic includes people who struggle to get speedy appointments at some Minneapolis area clinics, where five of the state's seven abortion clinics are located following the Supreme Court's decision. The seventh clinic is in Rochester. Quote, "The number of patients we serve has gone up, and the places they come from have gotten further away," Johnson said. The clinic isn't able to help everyone who calls. Cassidy Thompson, a patient educator and coordinator of the clinic's volunteer patient escort program, recounted a call from a woman in Oklahoma who was crying to me on the phone saying, "Can't you help me? No other clinics can take me right now." That patient was hoping for a telehealth consultation that would allow her to stay in Oklahoma and still obtain a medication abortion from the clinic. However, state law requires patients to have a Minnesota mailing address and to be physically in Minnesota when speaking with a doctor. "The entire purpose of my career is to provide abortion care and to tell someone we legitimately can't help them with anything and they are stuck with a forced pregnancy is just a complete takeaway of power," Thompson said. Most of the Minnesota patients at the clinic qualify for low-income assistance to help with the cost of an abortion, but it doesn't cover the full cost of the procedure. Casey estimated that the clinic lost more than $60,000 last year by serving medical assistant patients, a deficit the clinic had to make up through fundraising. Quote, a lot of doctors' offices put caps on how many medical assistance patients they might see. But we don't do that because we really want to provide for people that need it the most, said Paulina Briggs, the lab supervisor and a patient educator at the clinic. But out-of-state patients don't qualify for Minnesota's medical assistance program, nor does the clinic help out-of-state patients with travel costs. It doesn't have the resources, Casey said. All this contributes to financial strain for people traveling across state lines for abortion care. Quote, it's just really sad to think about those people, Briggs said. Where they live is going to determine the kind of care that they're going to get. And the people that are most in need of services are going to have the hardest time accessing them. Briggs said phones have been crazy with calls from people, including nurses, physician assistants, and an attorney, wanting to volunteer, help, or donate to the clinic, which also offers a range of non-abortion services, such as birth control and breast and cervical cancer screenings. The major challenge right now is just financial stability, making sure we have the financial resources to keep our clinic up and running, Casey said. It's just really sad that when I started here in 1981, we didn't have that many restrictive laws, and now we've just gone backwards, unquote. The next story also comes to the Courier by way of the Associated Press. Monkeypox virus could become entrenched as new STD in the U.S. Dateline New York. The spread of monkeypox in the U.S. could represent the dawn of a new sexually transmitted disease, though some health officials say the virus that causes pimple-like bumps might yet be contained before it gets firmly established. Experts don't agree on the likely path of the disease, with some fearing that it is becoming so widespread that it is on the verge of becoming an entrenched STD, like gonorrhea, herpes, and HIV. But no one's really sure, and some say testing and vaccines can still stop the outbreak from taking root. So far, more than 2,400 U.S. cases have been reported as part of an international outbreak that emerged 2 months ago. Health officials are not sure how fast the virus has spread. They have only limited information about people who have been diagnosed, and they don't know how many infected people might be spreading it unknowingly. They also don't know how well vaccines and treatments are working. One impediment, federal health officials do not have the authority to collect and connect data on who has been infected and who has been vaccinated. With such huge question marks, predictions about how big the U.S. outbreak will get this summer vary widely, from 13,000 to perhaps more than 10 times that number. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the government's response is growing stronger every day, and vaccine supplies will soon surge. Quote, I think we still have an opportunity to contain this, Walensky told the Associated Press. Monkeypox is endemic in parts of Africa, where people have been infected through bites from rodents or small animals. It does not usually spread easily among people. But this year, more than 15,000 cases have been reported in countries that historically don't see the disease. In the U.S. and Europe, the vast majority of infections have happened in men who have sex with men, though health officials have stressed that anyone can catch the virus. It spreads mainly through skin-to-skin contact, but it can also be transmitted through linens used by somebody with monkeypox. Although it's been moving through the population like a sexually transmitted disease, officials have been watching for other types of spread that could expand the outbreak. Symptoms include fever, body aches, chills, fatigue, and the bumps on parts of the body. The illness has been relatively mild in many men, and no one has died in the U.S., but people can be contagious for weeks, and the lesions can be extremely painful. When monkeypox emerged, there was a reason to believe that public health officials could control it. The telltale bumps should have made infections easy to identify, and because the virus spreads through close personal contact, officials thought they could reliably trace its spread by interviewing infected people and asking with whom they had been intimate. It didn't turn out to be that easy. With monkeypox so rare in the U.S., many infected men and their doctors may have attributed their rashes to some other cause. Contact tracing was often stymied by infected men who said they did not know the names of all the people they had sex with. Some reported having multiple sexual interactions with strangers. It didn't help that local health departments, already burdened with COVID-19 and scores of other diseases, now had to find the resources to do intensive contact tracing work on monkeypox too. Indeed, some local officials have given up expecting much contact tracing. There was another reason to be optimistic. The U.S. government already had a vaccine. The two-dose regimen called JYNNEOS was licensed in the U.S. in 2019 and recommended last year as a tool against monkeypox. When the outbreak was first identified in May, U.S. officials had only about 2,000 doses available. The government distributed them, but limited the shots to people who were identified through public health investigations as being recently exposed to the virus. Late last month, as more doses became available, the CDC began recommending that shots be offered to those who realize on their own that they could have been infected. Demand has exceeded supply, with clinics in some cities rapidly running out of vaccine doses, and health officials across the country saying that they don't have enough. That's changing, Walensky said. As of this week, the government has distributed more than 191,000 doses, and it has 160,000 more ready to send. As many as 780,000 doses will become available as early as next week. Once current demand is satisfied, the government will look at expanding vaccination efforts. The CDC believes that 1.5 million U.S. men are considered at high risk for the infection. Testing has also expanded. More than 70,000 people can be tested each week, far more than current demand, Walensky said. The government has also embarked on a campaign to educate doctors and gay and bisexual men about the disease, she added. Donal Bisanzio, a researcher at RTI International, believes U.S. health officials will be able to contain the outbreak before it becomes endemic. But he also said that won't be the end of it. New bursts of cases will probably emerge as Americans become infected by people in other countries where monkeypox keeps circulating. Walensky agrees that such a scenario is likely. Quote, if it's not contained all over the world, we are always at risk of having flare-ups from travelers, she said. Sean Kiernan of the Fairfax County Health Department in Virginia said there is reason to be tentatively optimistic because so far the outbreak has been concentrated in one group of people, men who have sex with men. Spread of the virus into heterosexual people will be a tipping point that may occur before it's widely recognized, said Kiernan, chief of the department's communicable disease section. At this point, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 25th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, since there are no obituaries in today's issue, let's continue reading from the opinion section. This next editorial comes from the Storm Lake Times Pilot and was written by Art Cullen. The title is Status Quo Safe So Far. Democrat Mike Franken is within striking distance of incumbent Republican Senator Chuck Grassley in the first Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll on their matchup. Grassley leads Franken 47-39% in the poll of likely Iowa voters. That's the closest Grassley has cut it against any challenger at this point in the campaign cycle since 1980. Still, 8 points is a lot of ground to gain. Franken's internal poll results released recently put the deficit closer to 5%. Go with the Iowa poll, directed by Ann Seltzer, the best in the business. While the poll released Saturday shows that people are tired of Grassley after sitting in Congress for 47 years, they tend to come home to the familiar when faced with a Democrat as the alternative. Tom Vilsack came from farther behind just a few weeks before the gubernatorial election to win. That was for an open seat against Jim Ross Lightfoot. This is an incumbent Chuck Grassley, who will have all the money, organization, and party commitment he needs to secure re-election. Franken is impressive. He raised more money than Grassley the last quarter. The retired Navy admiral is working the road hard, recently stumping around western Iowa with J.D. Schlotin, who took a job on the campaign. He is smart and pointed and clearly has the Grassley campaign nervous and irritated. They are off their game. Franken will continue to attack Grassley on patriotic grounds, that he stood by while the Constitution was trampled by insurrection. It's difficult arguing with an opponent who wears a faded Navy cap everywhere he goes. Attempts to define Franken as a socialist are almost impossible. Franken continues to raise questions about how Grassley responded to President Donald Trump's attempt to subvert the democratic process. He will attack Grassley over taking gobs of cash from the NRA while children are shot, and he will question why Grassley has done nothing but talk about protecting independent livestock producers. Franken is not well known. He should have the cash necessary to shape his own image while chipping away at Grassley's. Yet the challenger has a lot of ground to plow. Franken is not helped in the statewide campaign by the governor's race. Democrat Deirdre Dejere trails incumbent Republican Governor Kim Reynolds by 17 percentage points, the Iowa poll found. Reynolds leads the challenger by 11 points among independent voters. Voters do not know who Dejere is. She previously lost a Secretary of State race. She had no primary campaign to speak of when everyone else dropped out. Reynolds is not that popular. She gets only 48% support. The fact is that Iowa Democrats are flat on their backs. They are unlikely to gain many seats in the Senate or House if the top of their ticket is getting buried. It also doesn't help that the Democratic brand is taking a beating in Washington. Interesting that the Iowa poll was taken after the Iowa and U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the right to abortion is not guaranteed under the state or federal constitutions. Reynolds is stridently anti-abortion. If anything, it might have helped Reynolds, since Dejere's standing appears to have eroded in the Iowa poll since March. It also does not appear that the governor's attempts to ram through private school vouchers will hamper her electorally. She is campaigning on vouchers and banning abortion. It appears to be working for her in the current context. A lot can happen between now and Election Day. Higher interest rates already are having an impact on oil and grain prices. Trump jumping into the presidential race could impact politics in unforeseen ways, as could the many investigations around the big lie. Senate Democrats might get their act together to cut prescription drug prices and at least act like they care that the West is literally on fire. The prevailing individuals suggest that the status quo in Iowa politics, while wobbly, is not in imminent danger. It takes something extraordinary to upset an incumbent in Iowa. 8 points is a lot. 17 points is out of sight. Next, we have COVID Brain Fog, The Real Deal, an editorial by Rick Moraine, which appeared in the Storm Lake Times Pilot. I'm double vaccinated and double boosted. I tend to shy away from crowded indoor places. I'm not very reliable about masking anymore, but I figured my vaccines had made me pretty invulnerable to COVID-19. Wrong. Last Thursday evening, I developed a cough, sore throat, runny nose, low-grade fever, and significant fatigue. I broke out a home test, and sure enough, I tested positive for COVID. I know a couple of possible ways I picked it up, but there's no way to know for sure, and anyway, it doesn't really matter. I got it and needed to isolate and figure how I was going to handle my obligations. I spent most of my time in my easy chair or on the couch. I have very little energy for anything. I'm on jury duty in July. I called the clerk of the district court to report that I wouldn't be able to serve immediately, but that I should be okay before long. I canceled out of a couple of meetings. I figured out how to cover and write the news stories about local government sessions this week. I begged off a couple of dinners with friends that we had scheduled for the next few days, and I settled in to wait it out. It's not fun. Many of you have likewise picked up COVID-19, so you understand. My symptoms are not particularly serious, thanks to my vaccinations and boosters, but I'm missing half my right lung. I have mild to moderate COPD, and I'm in and out of atrial fibrillation, and I'm rebuilding my body strength from my hip replacement a month ago. And I'm 81 years old, so I have to be somewhat careful how I deal with the disease. Kathy is great. She picked up a Paxlovid prescription for me. That's the medication most often prescribed for COVID victims. She also got some sore throat medication and made sure we have plenty of Tylenol. I've hit the Kleenex pretty hard the past few days, so she built our supply of that as well. She reminds me regularly to drink plenty of fluids, eat adequately, and take my pills at the right time. I've noticed a little brain fog in the past few days, so I appreciate her attention to detail. We dog sat our grand dog Milo from Adele most of last week while his forever family was off to Chicago for a vacation trip. He's a sweet dog, loving and eager to please, and he made dealing with the disease more pleasant. Well wishes from family and friends, lots of them, have also boosted my spirits. I'm hoping I'll be through it and back on my regular schedule by this weekend. If not, so be it. I'll wait it out. Anyhow, that's about all I'm able to write about this week. Brain fog's a real thing. Please stick with me, and I expect to have something more weighty to say next week. And stay well. Rick Moraine is a reporter and columnist with the Jefferson Herald. Next is an opinion which first appeared in the New York Times, titled "The Myth of the Good Trump Official," and this one written by Michelle Goldberg. A central theme of the January 6th hearings has been Republican redemption. A parade of Republican witnesses has testified to being pushed beyond the limits of their loyalty to Donald Trump. For some, the breaking point came when he tried to enlist them in a scheme to overturn state elections. Others revolted at the former president's attempts to corrupt the Justice Department or at his role in inciting an insurrection. A rioter, awakened to Trump's lies, testified about being misled. In a poignant moment after the seventh hearing, he apologized to the Capitol Police. Republican Representative Liz Cheney, the January 6th committee's vice chair, has been perhaps its most prominent voice. At Thursday's primetime hearing, the last until September, she painted die-hard believers in Trump's big lie as noble victims. Quote, "Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened," said Cheney. "They would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her. And he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our capital and our Constitution," unquote. It is a sign of the committee's Democrats' love of country that they have allowed the hearings to proceed this way. They are crafting a story about January 6th as a battle between Republican heroism and Republican villainy. It seems intended to create a permission structure for Trump supporters to move on without having to disavow everything they loved about his presidency, or to admit that January 6th was the logical culmination of his sadistic policies. If you believe, as I do, that Trump's sociopathy makes him a unique threat to this country's future, it makes sense to try to lure Republicans away from him rather than damn them for their complicity. There is a difference, however, between a smart narrative and an accurate one. In truth, you can't cleave Trump and his most shameless anti-democratic enablers off the rest of the Republican Party, because the party has been remade in his image. Plenty of ex-Trump officials have come off well in the hearings, including the former Deputy National Security Advisor, Matthew Pottinger, the former Acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, and, in video testimony, the former White House Counsel, Pat Cipollone. That shouldn't erase the ignominy of having served Trump in the first place. I have a lot of respect for Cheney, who is likely sacrificing her future in Republican politics in her attempt to hold Trump accountable, and for the bravery of witnesses like Cassidy Hutchinson, who testified despite the Trump camp's reported attempt to intimidate her. But whatever they say now, the witnesses who worked for Trump enabled his mounting authoritarianism. Each contributed in his or her own way, not just to January 6th, but also to eroding our democracy, so that January 6th may be just a prequel. Each helped bring us to a point where, according to a recent survey, more than half of Americans believe a civil war will erupt in the United States in the near future. Quote, "It's a privilege to serve in the White House," Pottinger said during his testimony on Thursday. Quote, "I'm also very proud of President Trump's foreign policy accomplishments," unquote. Pottinger worked for the Trump administration from its beginning until January 7, 2021. He was one of many who didn't resign over Trump's defense of the rioters in Charlottesville, Virginia, his attempted extortion of President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, or his claims to have won an election he clearly lost, to cite just a few milestones. During Pottinger's testimony, he said that January 6th emboldened our enemies by giving them ammunition to feed a narrative that our system of government doesn't work, that the United States is in decline, unquote. But there's no way to separate that from the rest of Trump's legacy, or from Pottinger's own. He shouldn't be proud. One of the few Trumpists who seems to have really reckoned with what she participated in is Stephanie Grisham, who is Trump's former press secretary, though she never held a news conference. Quote, "I don't think I can rebrand. I think this will follow me forever," she told New York Magazine's Olivia Nuzzi last year. "I believe that I was part of something unusually evil," unquote. They all were. Everyone who kept that catastrophic administration functioning at a minimal level, while Trump built the cult of personality that made January 6th possible. It's important to remember their culpability, because Trump is probably going to run for president again. And he could win. If he does, Republicans who like to think of themselves as good people, who don't want to spend their lives in the right-wing fever swamps, will be faced with the question of whether to serve him. They will see the former Trump officials who were able to rebrand despite sticking with him almost to the end, and they might think there's not much to lose. In his bracing book, Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell, Tim Miller, a former Republican National Committee spokesman, tries to understand why friends and associates who once hated Trump eventually submitted to him. Quote, "There were thousands of people who at some level complied with Trump, who weighed the costs," he wrote, "who knew the dangers, who might have chosen a different path if they could have imagined a different, more fulfilling future for themselves," unquote. The January 6th committee is trying, against the suck of Trump's dark gravity, to point the way to such a future. To do that, it has been liberal with absolution. That doesn't mean absolution is deserved. Now we turn the page once again to the Northeast Iowa area escapades. Here are just a few of the events, shenanigans, and goings-on worth checking out this week in the Northeast Iowa area. Now on Tuesday, July 26th, music in the Overman Park Bandshell, one of Iowa's oldest concert bands, will perform their final summer concert Tuesday. Dennis Downs will conduct the Cedar Falls Municipal Band beginning at 7:30 p.m. at the Overman Park Bandshell in downtown Cedar Falls. The band's percussion ensemble will perform at 6:30 p.m. Popcorn and soft drinks will be sold by the Cedar Falls Rotary Club, with proceeds to benefit the band and local project. Bring a lawn chair or a blanket. Next, on Thursday, July 28th through Saturday, July 30th, all directions point north. Looking for a road trip? Head to Decora for Nordic Fest, Thursday through Saturday. Music, live entertainment, food, sports activities, yard and garden tours, demonstrations, and museum tours will be offered. The Nordic dancers will perform traditional folk dances of Scandinavia, accompanied by Nordic Dancers Orchestra. The Nordic Fest Beverage Garden will feature music by Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman on Thursday. Avery Growen's band, Grass Run Band, and David Zolo and the Body Electric on Friday, and the Pistol Whippin' Party Penguins on Saturday, among others. The Grand Parade is Saturday at 10 a.m. For a complete listing of events and activities, visit nordicfest.com. Next on Thursday, July 28th, Zoot and Newt at Party on the Patio. Kick back and relax Thursday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Party on the Patio. The event takes place on the Corning Patio at the Hearst Center for the Arts Sculpture Garden, 304 West Searley Boulevard, Cedar Falls. Zoot and Newt will perform. Refreshments will be available from Second State Brewery, and popcorn and Fit Pop. There is no charge to attend. Chairs are provided, but those attending can bring their own. Also on Thursday, July 28th, the Sullivan Tribute and Band Concert. The Waterloo Municipal Band will feature a tribute to the five Sullivan brothers at 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the River Loop Amphitheater in downtown Waterloo. It's the band's final concert for the summer. Paul Berensi will conduct, quote, We Stick Together, a piece he composed depicting the Sullivan story of sacrifice and loss during the World War II sinking of the USS Juno. Kelly Sullivan, granddaughter of Al Sullivan, the youngest Sullivan brother, will narrate. Danny Galeon will conduct the remainder of the concert. Sailors from the USS The Sullivans DD-537 and USS The Sullivans DDG-68 will be in Waterloo for a ship's reunion August 5th through 7th. They will be guests of honor at the Iowa Irish Fest August 5 through 7. It marks the 80th anniversary sinking of the Juno and the 25th birthday of USS The Sullivans DDG-68. Next, Friday, July 29th, more music on the plaza. River Place Plaza will feature Live to 9 Friday from 6 to 9 at 200 State Street in downtown Cedar Falls. Katie and the Honky Tonks will perform. Refreshments will be available to purchase. Visitors can also take advantage of nearby restaurants and night spots. Admission is free. Bring a blanket or lawn chair for comfort. Also on Friday, free music by the Cedar River. The Cedar River may just be the best backdrop for live performance in the Cedar Valley. Clarence Williams and the Rising Suns will be on stage for River Loop Rhythms Friday at the River Loop Amphitheater in downtown Waterloo. Music is from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. There will be food and beverages available to purchase. On Saturday, July 31st, pop-up concert at Hearst. Pianist Dean Hilbert of Waverly and violinist Jacob Reese of Sumner will perform a pop-up concert Sunday at 1:30 p.m. at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Searley Boulevard in Cedar Falls. The program will feature arrangements of hymns, folk tunes, classical pieces, and original works composed by Hilbert. It is free and open to the public. A free will donation will be accepted to help fund the repair of Hearst's Steinway piano. On Sunday, July 31st, Nature in an Urban Setting. On Sunday, families can join a naturalist in an urban outdoor setting for a program based on Iowa PBS Science Activity Journals. This Sunday summer series is an opportunity to learn more about the natural world from 2 to 3 p.m. at Hartman Reserve Nature Center, 657 Reserve Drive, Cedar Falls. The activity is free and registration is not required. Science activity journals will be provided. Now here is a summary list of festivals and celebrations in the area. Backbone Bluegrass Festival at Strawberry Point, Friday through Sunday. The National Balloon Classic Festival in Indianola, Friday through August 6th. The Iowa Irish Fest in Waterloo from August 5th through the 8th. Wachir Summer Flea Market in Wachir, August 5th through 7th. Iowa State Fair in Des Moines from August 11th through the 21st. Dyke Watermelon Days, August 12th through 14th. Old Time Power Show, Antique Acres, Cedar Falls, between August 19th and 21st. Cedar Valley Pride Fest, August 26th through 27th. Art-a-Palooza in Cedar Falls is September 10th. And lastly, National Cattle Congress Fair is September 21st through 25th. Now we turn to the sports page. Under the heading of IndyCar, New Garden Crash Clears Way for Award at Iowa. This story comes from Jenna Fryer of the Associated Press. New Garden taken to hospital, award wins at Iowa. Dateline, Newton, Iowa. Pato Award pounced on Joseph New Garden's misfortune Sunday to win the second race of the Iowa Speedway doubleheader, and Jimmy Johnson had the first top five finish of his IndyCar career. New Garden dominated and led 148 of the 300 laps while trying to sweep the weekend, but something on his Team Penske car broke with 64 laps remaining, and he spun hard into the outside wall. He was visibly rattled after his mandatory check in the infield care center. Definitely was a bit of a shot. I want to cry. So sad for my team. I don't know what happened, Newgarden said. Everything felt fine to me. Totally unexpected, and it caught me by surprise. Team Penske is the best. I never have this stuff, so maybe we were due. Quote, we can't afford it for this year, but we'll fight back. We have a great team here, unquote. Chevrolet's initial diagnosis was that the suspension broke on Newgarden's car. Award actually made the pass for the win on pit road with a speedy stop by his Aero McLaren SP team and held off Penske teammates Will Power and Scott McLaughlin for the win. It's the second win of the season for the Mexican driver, who finished second on Saturday and remains firmly in the IndyCar title race with five races remaining. Award is fifth in the standings, 36 points behind leader Marcus Ericsson. His win halted Team Penske's dominance on the 0.894-mile oval, where Roger Penske's drivers had won six of the last seven races prior to Sunday. Scott Dixon of Chip Ganassi Racing finished fourth and was followed by teammate Johnson, who raced hard with Indianapolis 500 winner Ericsson to earn his best finish through two seasons of IndyCar racing. Ericsson is also a Ganassi driver, and Newgarden's crash helped the Swede retain the lead in the IndyCar standings, making Johnson's aggressive racing a bit nerve-wracking for the Ganassi camp. Quote, I race my teammates with the most respect I possibly can. Every race I've been in, I've given way, Johnson said. That was really the first time I fought for position and felt like I should have been up there passing Dixon. Today I had it in me, and I raced clean, hard, and just had an awesome day, unquote. Ericsson said Johnson's experience on ovals was the difference. The seven-time NASCAR champion made 686 starts in the stock car and won 83 races. It was another podium sweep for Chevrolet, who did it on Saturday with Newgarden, Award, and Power. Newgarden was scored as the points leader at the time of his crash and dropped to a tie with Dixon for third in the standings following his crash. There are five drivers separated by 36 points in the standings, and Ericsson leads Power by 8 points. Team owner Bobby Rahal had been noticeably absent from the track for nearly 2 months and confirmed Sunday that the 1986 Indianapolis 500 winner underwent a triple bypass. Rahal told the Associated Press he went for a routine annual physical on May 5th, and doctors discovered he'd unknowingly suffered a heart attack, maybe two, and found 100% blockage in his left anterior descending artery. Rahal assumed surgery would be immediate, but it actually didn't happen until June 6th. Quote, surprised he leaked the news, but nonetheless, it's been an intense couple of months for our family, said Graham Rahal, wrote on Twitter. Quote, we're ultra lucky to still have Dad with us, very lucky. But now he's good for another 100,000 miles, we think. Many had asked where he's been, and now you have your answer, unquote. Up next, IndyCar and NASCAR share next weekend at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. IndyCar races Saturday on the road course, NASCAR races on Sunday. And listeners, that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 25th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.